His gospel's like putting new wine in new bottles. Unkind of him. On top of that, his disciples begin violating the Sabbath. And he talks about wine in new bottles. When they criticize his disciples for not fasting, he says they're on a wedding, honeymoon. Well, right from honeymoon to wine to violating the Sabbath. Three in a row. He could have been more gentle. I could preach all day on that, but let's keep going. Let's find the demons. Third chapter. I tell you, I've already flushed out 60 demons among the saints with my last few remarks. And unclean spirits, 11th verse, chapter 3. When they saw him, fell down before him and cried, saying, "Thou art the Son of God." Demons know how to praise God. They know how to sound very spiritual. In fact, they led the pack. There wasn't anybody else saying that. You'd think he'd have said, "Glad to meet you, brother. You're the first one that's recognized me." I mean, I can tell a Christian as far as I can see him. Would you speak at our next big Bohard businessman fellowship dinner? You got the mind of the Spirit, brother. Thou art the Son of God. Unclean spirits, when they saw him, fell down before him and cried, "Boo-ho!" saying, "Thou art the Son of God." They're full of the Holy Ghost. I feel revival in the air. The Spirit's in this place. I'm telling you, the Spirit's in this place. Ooh, ooh, I feel it coming. Thou art the Son of God. Woo! Do you feel that? Yes, Lord. And unclean spirits, when they saw him, fell down before him and cried. Mascara that ran. Saying, "Thou art the Son of God." Thank you. Cha 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 cha. Quench not the spirit, brother. Quench not the spirit. He straightly charged them that they should not make him known. He didn't even rebuke them. They were accurate. They didn't have to be. They were telling the truth. One of the few times a demon ever told the truth. They fell down in front of him. It's where they ought to be. On their face. En route to hell. You think, you know. Now, there might be some hopes for those demons. Think so? No, so. He straightly charged them that they should not make him known. Verses 14 and 15. Let's keep going. I think I did enough with that. I think that's something I don't even have to apply. He ordained 12 that they should be with him and that he might send them forth to preach and to have power to heal sicknesses and cast out demons. Sure, a lot of them running loose, aren't they? They don't understand him. They start turning on him. Pharisees who know better say he's casting out demons with the power of Beelzebub. He said, how can Satan cast out Satan? Then he tells them the parable of the sower, without which you can never understand the kingdom. And then he comes in the fifth chapter to that demon of the Gadarenes, name Legion. He besought him that they would not send them away out of the country. So he let them go into the pigs. The point is, there's lots of demons running loose, but they were terrorized about going into the abyss. The abyss is where Satan will go for 1,000 years, and the abyss is where those horrible locust demons come from. Now, if Atlantis was the headquarters of the pre-flood earth, if Atlantis was the place where the Garden of Eden was, if Atlantis was the mountain of God, in some way or other pierced the canopy, and to those on earth at least appeared to be the place of access to the heavens. We have an explanation why that the hieroglyphic in all ancient cultures includes in its views of God a mountain. The holy mountain has always been worshipped. Olympus was but a type for the Greeks. They always seek the holy mountain as the place where you find God. And if the Bible's true, we may have a reason why so much of the mythology of man speaks of gods and human beings mating. Because the Bible clearly speaks of the sons of God coming down and mating. And if Enoch, the righteous, grieved and prophesying of a doom to come as a descendant of Seth, as Josephus said, the descendants of Seth, knowing a Holocaust was coming, prepared a monument, one of brick, one of stone, the one of stone in Josephus' day, still standing in Egypt, none other than the pyramid. And if God sent Enoch, who was not, for God took him, with the watchers creatures from heaven to build this pyramid, to store the knowledge that would go through the Holocaust. And if Atlantis sank beneath the waves, as Otto Muck says, the rifts on each side. Let's see if I can find the picture. I'll get you back to the mass eventually. If I don't today, I will tomorrow. You know, always get back. Otto Muck has a nice picture of the way he thinks Atlantis sunk. Here it is. Not too far off from the drifting continents, by the way. Atlantis, this would be the European African continent side. This would be the North and South American side. Atlantis in the middle. Some granite plug in the rifts between. We don't know what's way down there. And when the catastrophe and cataclysm came, when the firmament broke above and the fountains of the deep, it says, broke open, these plugs could have blown, Atlantis sunk, then regelled, volcanic breakthroughs, regelled again, but the whole island mass sunk until the Azores and the Canaries and these islands represent what used to be the mountaintops on Atlantis. That's Otto Muck, the secret of Atlantis, his theory. He spends a great deal of time on continental drift that has been, interestingly enough, given some real credence in geology in recent years. And if I can find the right picture or map, because I'm prepared to do this. The only problem with the continental drift theory is there's a hole that's missing. Africa and Europe do not quite fit when you shove them like a jigsaw puzzle into North and South America, because there's a hole in the territory that is the territory of Atlantis. Otto Muck has a nice picture of that somewhere, if I could find it in time. Why do the eels, as we said the other day, searching for the freshwater rivers, the ones on the west side of the Sargasso Sea, swim a very short distance? The ones on the east side go all the way to Europe, have a 2-year journey under the Gulf Stream, fighting their way back to the Sargasso Sea. It's as though they instinctively were created, some to swim west and some to swim, or some to swim west and some east, but the fresh waters of Atlantis were there before it sunk. Now it's a long trip to Europe. Here's Wegener's theory of continental drift, the origins of the Atlantic Ocean, that the continents began to drift apart. Originally, there was one big land mass and one sea, which is a little more accurate in the description of Genesis of the dividing of the waters from the land. And as they drifted apart, by Wegener's theory, we now have the continents separated through continental drift, because the surface is not that solid as we would view it. And I'm back to relativity again. The only problem is they don't quite fit. When you mash them together, there's something missing. Atlantis that sunk in that area. Now, I showed you some pictures from this book, Atlantis, the Eighth Continent. One of them that's almost scary as you look at it in the picture. Let's see if I can find it again. Yeah. This round hole in the ocean plunges down from the shallow 3 fathoms Bahama banks to a depth which has not yet been firmly established. Depth recorders have not found bottom at 2,800 feet. The breadth of this hole can be sort of visualized when you realize that white dot there is a 50-foot ship. Now, that 50-foot ship translated into the size of a football field six times. So put six of those ships along, and you still got what looks like about four to five football fields wide, and maybe 8 to 10 football fields long. And they haven't found the bottom yet. Now, what's your candidate for the abyss? If Atlantis was the seat of civilization in the pre-flood world, and it sunk, if God can chain them above in the area of the Euphrates River, which gives an easy explanation for the senseless cruelty and horror and viciousness of that area of the world that our genteel Christian Western mind simply can't cope with or comprehend. Satan's seat on earth, Babylon. Well, there are more of them that are chained in some abyss than there are running loose. I always like to start with natural explanations, but I don't rule out the supernatural. What's going on in this Bermuda Triangle, which is the territory where Atlantis was to have sunk? Can we go back to the mass? Well, the first wanted missing vessel. I want to read from the Devil's Triangle 2, Richard Weiner again. That's where the mass is. But first, wanted missing vessel. Now, Jesus said, if you hate in your heart, if you hate in your heart. Now, some of you went out and bought this other book. It's all right. Go ahead. This one's not that easy to find. If you can find this one, Mike, I may even give them away. You know, I'm just hunting and picking this. This got some interesting little stories in it. I just hunt and pick out of all of them. I'd like to have these. I'd give this one away. But since I don't have them, I'll read it. Wanted, missing vessel, $2,500 reward. Contact USCG, that's Coast Guard. SAR, Sea Air Rescue Center, Miami or Basra H. Why does the government like have all these acronyms? Nassau. Hundreds of such notices were posted on boat yards, at marinas, and on dock pilings throughout Florida and the Bahama Islands during March and April 1974 after the disappearance of the brand new yacht Saba Bank. Now, if you that are out there would like to hear this when we're live with you again or on a rerun, you better call. I mean, I just want to make a simple point. But when I make a simple point, I like to make it am I making the simple point? Wanted, missing vessel, $2,500 reward. Contact Coast Guard, Nassau. Hundreds of notices were posted around Florida, Bahama Islands during March and April 1974. I'm reading The Devil's Triangle 2, Richard Weiner, page 132. These postings were after the disappearance of the brand new yacht Saba Bank. The vessel, especially equipped for taking out charter diving parties, was last seen at Nassau's Yacht Harbor on March 10, 1974. She was last heard from on March 24th, 14 days later, while on a shakedown cruise that was part of her maiden voyage. The Saba Bank was due to arrive in Miami on April 8th. Aboard the missing vessel was its four-man crew. Well-known Philadelphia orchestra leader Cy Zentner, 32. Elliot Cohn, 30, also from Philadelphia. Raphael Kaplan, 26, of Sickerville, New Jersey. And John Targuinio, 42, of Vineland, New Jersey. The yacht was owned by the Vasco Corporation of Wilmington, Delaware. First time I've said this in weeks, but it's too cold in here. Turn that frigid blower off. Turn it plumb off for a few minutes. The yacht was owned by the Vasco Corporation of Wilmington, Delaware, which offered the $2,500 reward for information on the Saba Bank's whereabouts. On April 25th, the Coast Guard gave up the search, which had begun on April 10th and reached as far as Central America. On April 26th, the United Press International dispatched a release, Dateline Miami, that began, quote, a $300,000 yacht on a shakedown cruise may have become the latest victim of the mysterious Devil's Triangle. It was daylight. We'll get back to the mass. It was daylight, but the sun had not yet lifted above the horizon. The weather was clear, balmy, as the motor vessel Atlantic City plied westward less than a day away from her destination, Newport News, Virginia. A long Atlantic swell running from the east periodically gave the freighter's stern a gentle heave upward. It was a typical summer morning in 1955. Most of the crew were still sleeping. W.J. Morris of Lantrison, South Wales, was on lookout duty atop the Atlantic City's bridge. Soon it would be time to awaken the rest of the crew and ready for the ship, or to ready the ship for entering port. Morris was joined by the officer of the watch, who chatted for a few minutes before returning below to the wheelhouse. Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging and circling erratically. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great... Now let's go back to the mass. Why don't we just go home? Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging and circling erratically. Then the two men saw blank, 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 and heading directly for the ship. It was on a collision course with the Atlantic City. Panicking, Morris began to jump over the wind dodger to the foredeck below. The mate grabbed him and pulled him back to the deck. The two terrified men lay there covering their faces. Hearing no noise whatsoever, they looked up. The blank was nearly upon them. It's blank, 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 blank. The Star of Peace, formerly the Lover Boy. Let's leave that one for a minute. The Star of Peace, formerly the Lover Boy. How do you get from one to the other? I don't know. And the Star of the Pacific was a 138-foot, three-masted schooner with a gross weight of 170 tons. She was built as a yacht in 1924 at the Bethlehem Shipyard in Wilmington, Delaware, for the president of Studebaker Motor Car Company. Other owners down through the years included Robert Ullian, president of the Schlitz Brewing Company. Now, you're going to say he was sampling his wares. The daughter of the Colgate toothpaste family and a syndicate of Puerto Rican businessmen. During World War II, the Star of Peace served as... Are you starting to get a little bit convinced the strange goings-on permeate the Bermuda Triangle? During World War II, the Star of Peace served as a Navy coastal patrol craft off the eastern seaboard of the United States. Anybody want to row from Florida to... She's credited with participating in the sinking of two German U-boats. After the war, she was owned by Texas A&M University, used as an oceanographic research ship. In 1971, Conrad McCulloch, a Buffalo, New York fire extinguisher manufacturer, restored the schooner to her original lines. At that time, her name was changed from Star of the Pacific to Star of Peace. McCulloch donated the use of the schooner to the League of Families of POWs of the Vietnam War. In conjunction with this, in 1974-75, the ship made a 41,000-mile voyage to Vietnam to publicize the Nixon administration side of the POW issue, playing a diplomatic role in negotiations between the United States and North Vietnam. The vessel spent 18 months cruising Asiatic waters on behalf of the prisoners of war. The Star of Peace was to sail to Hanoi. However, when it was learned that Jane Fonda and other activists were going to be in the communist city at the same time, it was felt that they might interfere with the mission of the Star of Peace. Thus, the ship headed back to the United States, arrived at her home port, Fort Lauderdale, July 74, on Tuesday. January 28, 1975, the Star of Peace set sail for San Salvador and the Bahamas for several weeks of cruising and diving. Some of McCulloch's business associates were to meet the vessel there. It was good sailing weather on January 30th as the Star of Peace reached along under full sail. The rays of the subtropical winter sun appeared to be dancing on top of the waves. The air was warm. Most of the crew were lazily sitting or standing around the deck. The wind in the rigging, the sound of the sea, and the schooner's heeling hull plunging through the waves were all that broke the silence of the ocean. The only machinery running was below decks, where a small air compressor was being used to fill scuba diving tanks. The vessel was under command of Dan Smith, an executive in McCulloch's firm. Others aboard included John Messer and Jack Kyan, both of Fort Lauderdale, Randy Keith of Merritt Island, Florida, and Jerry Baldiga of Dudley, Massachusetts. Early in the afternoon, Smith went below to check the compressor. The tank being filled registered only 1,500 pounds. A full tank holds 2,200 pounds of air pressure. Another 10 to 15 minutes of filling would do it. The safety tolerance of the tank was over 3,000 pounds. Smith headed topside. Just as he reached the deck, and now let's go to the mass. Back to the mass. But before we get there, Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating out of Key West. You know what I ought to do? I ought to leave all this dangling. Find a source for this book and give it away next Sunday. Get all you carnal people in church for a change. Another large vessel was the Dawn. Now, we've got Star of Peace, otherwise known as Lover Boy, and Smith below deck, and just as he reached the deck, and we've got Atlantic City. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a gun right there. And we've got Yamacraw by the mass. Well, let's add one more. Four covers the whole earth. Am I boring you? I just love to tell you bedtime stories. Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating out of... You know, the strange things happen in the Bermuda Triangle. Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating... What do you suppose causes all these things to happen in the Bermuda Triangle? Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating out of Key West. Oh, one of the most famous stories about the Devil's Triangle is the story of the ghost ship Connemara 4. One of the most mysterious occurrences in the Devil's Triangle. Well, let's go back to the Dawn. What happened to Yamacraw? I lost the place on Yamacraw. Oh, there it is. I hope I got enough fingers to hold all these things down. On deck, back to the Yamacraw. If you weren't so smart, I wouldn't be able to jump around like this. You'd forget where I was. That's the way I eliminate the ones that shouldn't be listening to me. On deck, visibility was absolutely zero. I'm on the Yamacraw now, and the mass is out there. Some of the men groping their way around the Yamacraw's deck commented that the substance into which they had steam felt like suspended particles of fine sand or dust. Yet there was no movement of the mass, as there would have been had it been one of those rare dust storms at sea. The air was dead still. The ship moved forward with just enough way to maintain steerage. The radar screen showed only a green clutter. The ship's compasses still worked. Suddenly, there was a spontaneous... Now, that's where we were, wasn't it? I wanted to be sure I could find it again. In the Devil's Triangle, I included the story of the ghost ship Connemara 4, which to me was one of the most mysterious occurrences in the Devil's Triangle. So be it. Back to Dawn. Another large vessel was the Dawn, a 73-foot shrimping vessel operating out of Key West. Are you jumping ship with me? The Dawn was typical of the shrimp boats that dragged the waters of the Atlantic coast from the Virginia Cape south around Florida and into the Gulf of Mexico. White hull and superstructure. Got a picture of old Black Hall and superstructure here. There's old Black Hall and superstructure. See right there, W333, white superstructure and black hull. Now, Dawn, white superstructure and white hull. White hull and superstructure with black trim. And nets hanging from her booms when not in use. You gotta watch them all. There's something tricky about them all. I'm telling you, you can't drop your guard. Wherever a hull is, you gotta watch it. Nets hanging from her booms when not in use. I have trouble visualizing that. I'm usually pretty imaginative. The Dawn. That'll wake you up, all right. The Dawn, captain and owned by Albert Clark of Key West, was working the waters east of Florida Keys during late April 1975. Also aboard were two crewmen, Ralph Myers and George Parrish, both of St. Mary, Georgia. The Shrimper Dawn was last seen on April 22nd, 10 miles northwest of Smith's Shoal Light, a small beacon by a passing boat. The Dawn, with three experienced seamen aboard, was never seen or heard from again. Seven aircraft, five Coast Guard, one Navy, and one Air Force searched over 8,200 square miles of ocean, but they found no trace of the missing Shrimper. The search ended almost exactly a year after the search for Sava Bank was terminated. Let's go back to am I boring you?
No.
We took care of Dawn. I finished her. In The Devil's Triangle, one, his other book, Richard Weiner says, I included the story of the ghost ship Connemara 4, which to me is one of the most mysterious occurrences in The Devil's Triangle. She was found crewless and adrift some 400 miles southwest of Bermuda in September 1955. The large yacht was somewhat battered, but still afloat and sound. Along Connemara 4's track from New York to where she was found, there passed Hurricane Connie during the second week in August, with winds up to 100 miles an hour. Less than a week later, Hurricane Diane, with its 125 miles per hour winds, roared over the exact same area, claimed more than 200 lives. The exact place where this boat, found crewless, but battered but still afloat and sound, it weathered two hurricanes. There was more to come for the yacht Connemara 4. Within 2 weeks, Hurricane Ione battered the identical sector of the Devil's Triangle with its 125 mile per hour winds. Most blue water sailors agree that for the crew of a yacht to have remained at sea continuously for a month and be belted to three hurricanes during that period would be almost beyond human endurance. The only mystery about the yacht Connemara 4 is how she managed to survive three consecutive hurricanes. One can only comprehend the ferocity of a hurricane at sea by living through the experience. But to survive one storm, to have another strike, even before the waves of the first have diminished, and then to have yet a third slam in is almost unthinkable. Sounds incredible, doesn't it?
I too thought so until I received a letter from Mr. J. E. Chaloner of Barbados. Well, let's try another one. In the devil's trying, I'm making you mad. About half as mad as I get, I'm taking it out on you. But I'm really taking it out on them. About half as mad as I get when they don't call me. In the devil's triangle, the Rafuka Maru. Now, the Rafuka Maru is something we ought to consider. It made an uneventful passage across the Pacific, through the Panama Canal and into the Caribbean. But as the ship steamed past the Bahama Islands, the Japanese crew found the strange happenings were more than legend in the waters of the Western Atlantic. For the last that was ever heard from the freighter Rafuka Maru was the code message, "Danger like dagger, come quick." Then silence. What happened to the Japanese ship? No oil slick, no wreckage remains. Another one to disappear without a trace. But let's leave Connemara 4 and go back to the... Oh, I forgot, didn't I? Atlantic City. Plied westward, less than a day away from her destination, Newport News. Am I making the simple point that some strange things go on? After a while, you know, all these ships sort of blend together and it becomes one big blob of mystery, each with her own strange story. Less than a day from her destination, Newport News, Virginia. W.J. Morris, South Wales, topped the Atlantic City's bridge. Soon it'd be time to waken the rest of the crew, ready the ship for entering port. Morris was joined by the officer of the watch. They chatted a few moments. Suddenly the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild. This is where we were, right? Zigzagging and circling erratically. You can turn the cooler back on now. Getting heated up. Then the two men saw. Your nerves are on edge. You don't really believe I'll finish. You think I'm going to do it again. As your faith is? I was going to finish, but I picked it up from your vibrations. I picked it up from you. They have no faith in me. You're to blame. They're to blame, folks. I would have finished. But they're releasing all these negative vibes in here. Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging and circling erratically. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great ball of fire, traveling rapidly and heading directly for the ship. Now apologize. Then you aren't either, you're lying, you're just saying whatever you think will keep me going. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great ball of fire traveling rapidly and heading directly for the ship. It was on a collision course with the Atlantic City. Panicking. Understandable. Am I boring you? Panicking. Morris began to jump over the wind dodger to the foredeck below. The mate grabbed him and pulled him back to the deck. The two terrified men lay there covering their faces. Hearing no noise whatsoever, they looked up. The fireball was nearly upon them. Its glare made them squint. making no roar or noise whatsoever. It Now let's go to the maps. Why should I continue with nobody talking to me? Now, I'm going to spoil you. That's what I'm going to do. I'm bored. I'm used to a class a little more alive. I'm used to the phones just getting on fire like great balls of fire. I'm not going to go any further if I don't get some more calls, you know? Just here a little, there a little, line upon line, precept upon precept, dangle after dangle. Here, there, little, and there, little. You better call me. I can just leave it right here. Never come back to the subject. I'm heading back to the Atlantis, the eighth continent. Well, here's Tivoli, Texas, on the edge of her chair and losing fingernails rapidly. Ah. Whittier, if you dangle any more, I hope you have dinner with a rubber woman. Glendale, did you go to dangle school to learn this? No, it comes natural to me. Glendale, how many do you have dangling now? The entire 7th Fleet? Denver, by the way, you usually go off at 6 o'clock. And it's now 20 minutes to 7. You're still on. If you go off before finishing, I'm going to strangle you. I got so frustrated I could cry. Mom Scott called on behalf of all of her relatives and said, tell Doctor, go on. He's about to give me a nervous breakdown. Well, all I'm trying to do is suggest to you some strange things go on in the Bermuda Triangle. Well, let's go back to the Star of Peace. Okay? Early in the afternoon, Smith went below to check the compressor. You remember that one? The tank being filled registered only 1,500 pounds. The safety tolerance was over 3,000. Another 10 to 15 minutes would fill it, and no way it would reach the maximum amount. Smith headed topside. Just as he reached the deck. Now, I want to start something else. Did you ever hear about the coffins that danced? Strange. You know, it's not limited to ships and disappearances. We found things underwater, we found things on water, and found things above water. Here's a goodie. In Barbados, between 1811 and 1820, there occurred a series of events so bizarre and sacrilegious that witnesses were totally baffled by what they'd seen. The May 1945 issue of the Journal of the Barbados Museum and Historical Society contained a documented account of this unresolved and unsolved mystery. There's a crypt there. The crypt's slightly over 12 feet by 6 inches inside. Here's a picture of it. What are you doing over there? My Lord of mercy, I'm reading from The Devil's Triangle 2, Richard Weiner. You don't move as fast as you did before you got married. You're slowing down, man. Fact or legend? There's the crypt. See, it's open. Now, let me talk to you about it. The crypt, slightly over 12 feet by 6 feet inside, is constructed of coral blocks cemented together so tightly that the walls appear to be a continuation of the lower portion, which was hacked out of the solid coral rock upon which the cemetery sits. The single entrance was sealed by a huge block of blue marble that weighed nearly 1,000 pounds. See, some of these happenings in the triangle, one or two of them, you can give a natural explanation to, maybe. But it keeps piling up. The single entrance was sealed by a huge block of blue marble that weighed nearly 1,000 pounds. When sealed, the tomb was virtually impenetrable. In July 1807, a casket containing the body of Mrs. Thomasina Goddard was deposited in the vault. A year later, another coffin holding the remains of 2-year-old Mary Ann Maria Chase, who had died of one of the many childhood diseases so prevalent in those days, was placed alongside the one holding Mrs. Goddard. For the next 4 years, the crypt remained closed. Then Dorcas Chase, little Mary Ann's older sister, was interred on July 6, 1812. Just a month later, Thomas Chase would follow his daughter to the grave. After the huge marble slab was removed, lantern-carrying graveyard workers descended into the chamber to ready it for the deposition of Thomas Chase's body. It took only a few seconds for the laborer's eyes to adjust to the semi-darkness in the tomb. Without taking time for a second look, they fled in terror. Because they were slaves, no one believed them when they tried to explain what they had seen. Finally, the good rector of Christ Church, the Reverend Thomas Orderson, entered the burial room to see what had shaken the workers so much that they chose punishment for insubordination rather than re-enter the vault. When the Reverend entered the tomb, he was awe-stricken at what he saw. Strange things happen in this area. You got that? Am I making that? When I make a simple point, I like to make it. You got that, didn't you? When the Reverend entered the tomb, he was awe-stricken at what he saw. I can tell some of you are getting bored. I catch every movement. Some of you are bored. When the Reverend entered the tomb, he was awe-stricken at what he saw. The caskets were completely disarranged. The one that contained the remains of the Chase infant was standing head down in the corner, opposite where it had originally been placed. That of her older sister was turned end for end. The coffin containing Mrs. Goddard was lying on its side against one wall. "Blasphemous desecration," screamed Reverend Orderson. It was at first believed that the sacrilege was the work of the dissident slaves. However, the slaves were more frightened than were their white accusers. Because the Honorable Thomas Chase was apparently not so honorable, in fact, he was one of the most disliked men on Barbados, the blacks were sure that forces more powerful than man had cast the coffins asunder. The caskets were rearranged back to their original position. The body of Thomas Chase in a huge lead coffin that required 8 men to handle was placed in the crypt. The Reverend Orderson made a last-minute inspection of the vault's interior to ensure that everything was as it should be, then ordered the huge block of marble positioned back in place, sealing the tomb. Now, you know, I teach with what I call gestalt psychology, learning theory, field theory. You run the whole mass by often enough, after a while a little insight hits you. Now, in this case, has the insight come? Strange things happen in the Bermuda Triangle. The Reverend Orderson made a last-minute inspection of the vault's interior to ensure that everything was as it should be, then ordered the huge block of marble, 1,000 pounds, positioned back in place, sealing the tomb. For the next 4 years, it seemed as though nothing had occurred in the Chase vault. The cemetery workers returned to their chores at the sugar refineries or cane fields, except when their services were required at the graveyard. England was at war with the United States. Thus, numerous British ships called at the Barbados en route to the eastern seaboard of the United States. In 1816, the War of 1812 had been over for a year, and most of the young men impressed into the Navy returned home on September 25th of that year, 1816. Little Samuel Brewster Ames died shortly before his first birthday. Again, the huge marble slab, 1,000 pounds, remember, was hoisted away from the entrance. The Reverend Orderson, lantern in hand, was the first to enter the repository. As the lamp's glow flooded the chamber, the Reverend once again found the coffins in a state of disarray. The islanders were furious at this desecration of the dead. And as before, the blacks were accused of the deed, especially because of the numerous slave uprisings in the previous April. After the first furor was over, the Reverend Orderson climbed among the scattered coffins. There had been no attempt to open the caskets. Thus, grave robbery was discounted. The one containing Mr. Chase could have been moved by no less than a half a dozen men. Normally, it took 8 men. It was lying on its side on the opposite side of the crypt from where it had originally been placed. The other coffins had been, as before, strewn about. After the slaves replaced the coffins in their original positions, the Reverend, accompanied by Major Finch, secretary to the governor, examined the tomb and found nothing structurally amiss. The Ames child's body was placed in the crypt, and with great care, the marble slab, 1,000 pounds, was lowered back into place. The heavy A-frames that were used to position and lower it were removed. To test the door, 8 large men tried to shift it, but it wouldn't budge. The mourners departed, assured that everything was secure at the tomb. 52 days later, the vault was again ordered open. Samuel Brewster, the father of the little boy previously entombed, was to be the next occupant. He had been murdered by his slaves during the April revolt and temporarily buried at the parish of St. Philip elsewhere on the island. The big A-frame was erected in place above the marble slab, a block and tackle rigged, and with great effort, 12 slaves hoisted it away. This time, the Reverend Orderson entered the Chase vault accompanied by the governor, Lord Combermere, and a magistrate. Even before they entered, they knew that something was again amiss. The crowd of onlookers gathered around the entranceway, pushing closer. 4 of the 5 coffins were strewn about inside the crypt. Only Mrs. Goddard's body, or rather, only Mrs. Goddard's badly deteriorated wooden coffin remained in place. The others were made of lead. This time, not only the blacks, but also some of the whites were beginning to think the vault was cursed. The following day, the coffins, including Mrs. Goddard's, which had to be bound with rope to keep it from falling apart, were removed from the crypt and placed on the ground outside, while Reverend Orderson and 3 other men scrutinized the vault. Every part, both inside and out, was checked and rechecked for any possible entryway. The search proved there was no way to get into the vault without moving the heavy slab. And since a wooden structure would have been required to do so, anyone attempting it would have been noticed. There was no indication of water having entered the tomb. No earth tremors or other natural disturbances had occurred. All the adjacent structures were undisturbed. The men could find no way in which an unauthorized entry could have been gained. The caskets were placed back in the mausoleum and stacked in their original order, with the exception of Mrs. Goddard's, which stood on end in a corner. Poor Mrs. Goddard. Sam Brewster's coffin was laid to rest with the others. Again, the slaves lowered the marble slab into place, leaving the house of the dead sealed off from the rest of the world. Or at least this world, anyway. Cement was applied all around the slab where it came in contact with the tomb. Word of the strange happenings in the Christchurch sepulchre had spread throughout the West Indies and even as far north as Florida and the Bahamas. Hordes of sightseers converged on Barbados to look at the enigmatic Chase vault. Ships sailed many miles out of their way so that their passengers and crews might go ashore at Barbados and visit the graveyard. The people of Barbados bode their time awaiting the next funeral, praying for somebody to die so they could have another look. And it happened. Mrs. Thomasina Clark, a relative of the Chase family. Mrs. Clark went about her daily chores unaware that it would be her body for whom the tomb would be next opened. On July 7th, 1819, the wooden A-frame lifting device was again erected in the heavy marble block, ready for removal from the entrance of the infamous depository for the dead. Got to talk fast. I'm running out of time. Government officials carefully examined the cement that had been applied to the joint between the marble slab and the doorway to the vault. Let it run. Don't even recognize the 6 o'clock, whatever time, 5 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 1 o'clock, whatever time. Just let me go. I want to finish something. For a change... The Lord said, go home. We'll have to finish it some other time. You'll just have to all tune in another time. I mean, when I'm dealing with things this mysterious, I dare not resist. Gonna have to go now, folks. You're going to have to all repent for what's going on in your mind right now. Going to have to talk about the coffins that danced some other time. And we got the mass. Oh, and we've got the guy down below deck pumping the... And I've got a whole story about Atlantis. And the fireball, no, the fireball we took care of. Well, we didn't finish it, did we? Oh, my. Come on over here, Ron. Let's have a little music. Let's have a little music now. You all know that we return, like MacArthur. I return. You know, it was in my spirit and in my heart to finish. Until that sign from somewhere. Now let's go get a little food in our bellies, peace in our hearts, and forgiveness in our spirits, and money out of our pocketbooks, and we'll pick up somewhere near this point on one of these mysteries again. I really feel that this is one of the times that I leave when I'm not entirely loved.